ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. March comes to a close a little bit late, I know, as we honor actor Robert Preston yet again, and guest Kimberly Pierce will join me to discuss the movie that made Robert Preston a legend, 1962's The Music Man.
Attention, please. I can handle your troubled friend. Now you know I can. Oh, yes, I can. Please observe me if you will. I'm Professor Harold Hill, and I'm speaking of a big fat picture, The Music Man. I say Broadway's biggest long-run hit is coming right here to your screen. Yes, Professor Harold Hill's on hand. Now for a peek at The Music Man. Not a big peek, just a little peek.
As Robert Preston was easing his way back into films post-World War II, composer Meredith Willson was attempting to write a stage play about his childhood growing up in Mason City, Iowa, where he played Piccolo for John Philip Sousa. In 1948, he set down the memories of this time in his memoir, And There I Stood With My Piccolo. This being his first attempt to bring that memoir to life, bringing it forward in any medium was tough. He tried to launch it as a television special, and also pitched it to MGM head Jesse L. Lasky as a movie. Who knows what would have happened had The Music Man been made in the early 50s. Willson eventually settled down with Franklin Lacey to work on turning it into a stage musical. By the 1950s, Robert Preston's career wasn't exactly where he wanted it to be. He'd spent over a decade playing heavies or second bananas in a string of by-the-numbers westerns and dramas. So in the late 50s, Preston left Hollywood and went to work on the stages of Broadway. By the time Preston arrived, The Music Man had been wallowing in development for 8 years, had over 40 different drafts of its script written, and produced 40 songs, of which only 18 would eventually be used in the finished product. The musical The Music Man opened at the Majestic Theater on December 19, 1957, with Preston playing con man Professor Harold Hill. It would perform for 1,375 performances, closing its original incarnation in 1961. Preston, who had never done a musical prior to this, would receive a Tony for his performance, one of the few awards he'd receive in his lifetime.
Well, you got trouble, my friend. Right here, I say trouble right here in River City. Why, sure, I'm a billiard player. Certainly mighty proud to say I'm always mighty proud to say it. I consider that the hours I spend with a cue in my hand are golden. Help me cultivate horse sense and a cool head and a keen eye. Did you ever take and try to give an ironclad leave to yourself from a three-rail billiard shot? But just as I say it takes judgment, brains, and maturity to score in a bop-line game, I say that any boob can take and shove a ball in a pocket. And I call that sloth the first big step on the road to the depths of degradation. I say first, medicinal wine from a teaspoon, then beer from a bottle.
Naturally, Hollywood came calling to finally turn The Music Man into a major motion picture, one of many Broadway transplants attempting to revitalize a crumbling studio system in the 60s. Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra had tried to buy the film rights from Meredith Willson, with themselves in the lead, but Willson turned them down, eventually settling on Warner's as the home studio for The Music Man. Morton DaCosta, who directed the show on stage, was retained to direct the feature, a rarity in the musical game. Others from the stage play, like the musical group Buffalo Bills, also reprised their roles. And most surprisingly, nearly all 18 original stage songs were kept. It would seem natural to have Preston play Harold Hill, but Warner's was skeptical. They asked numerous A-list stars, including Dan Daly, Gene Kelly, and Cary Grant to take the role, but all refused. Preston was brought in, along with Shirley Jones, who was 16 years younger than Preston and pregnant at the time, alongside Ron Howard for the finished product, 1962's The Music Man.
Oh, what can I do, my dear, to catch your ear? I love you madly, madly, Madam Librarian, Marion. Heaven help us if the library caught on fire and the volunteer hose brigade men had to whisper the news to Marion. Madam Librarian.
Released in June of 1962, The Music Man was a massive success, receiving positive reviews and becoming the fifth highest-grossing film of the year. It was also Warner's biggest success for the studio in general. In 2003, The Wonderful World of Disney produced a made-for-TV remake of the film starring Matthew Broderick in the Preston role. The film was nominated for 5 Emmys, despite mixed reviews citing that it didn't compare to the original. Back in 1962, Robert Preston was nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Actor in a Comedy or Musical for his Harold Hill performance, but he failed to garner an Oscar nomination that year. The Music Man became synonymous with Preston and is the role he's best known for. Despite the Music Man's success, though, Preston's career never went to the epic heights that we all thought. After the film's success, he embraced his musical tastes, starring in the 1965 Mary Martin stage musical I Do, I Do, which garnered him a second Tony. He later starred as Mack Sennett opposite Bernadette Peters in the 1974 play Mack and Mabel, and starred opposite Lucille Ball in the infamous film adaptation of the musical MAME. In 1981, he teamed up with director Blake Edwards on two films, including 1982's Victor Victoria, a performance that gave Preston the only Oscar nomination in his entire career. Robert Preston died of lung cancer on March 21, 1987, at 68 years old. He never gave many interviews, and there's no official biography about him, but thankfully, we'll always have his Harold Hill. When we come back, Kimberly Pierce joins me to visit River City and 1962's The Music Man. Trouble in River City, everybody, and I am here to talk about it with my fantastic guest, Kimberly Pierce. That's right, this week we are continuing our foray into the work of Robert Preston with a look at 1962's The Music Man. Kimberly, how are you today?
Good, how about you?
I am pretty intrigued to talk about this because I literally just finished this. By the time of recording, I finished this about 30 minutes ago.
I was just rewatching it myself.
This took me a day and a half because it is a very, very long 2.5 hour film. In case you don't know The Music Man, which honestly, I probably knew more about it from outside sources than the actual film. It follows con man Professor Harold Hill, played by Robert Preston, who goes to the small town of River City, Iowa, to sell the town on the notion of making this boy's band. Of course, there is no band, and the intent is to just fleece them of their money and then abscond with the cash. But things take a complication because, of course, there's a girl in this film played by Shirley Jones, and Harold Hill comes to realize the joys of small town Americana. You and I come at this from two very different approaches. I always knew when we were going to talk about Robert Preston that I was going to have to do The Music Man because it is easily the only film most people know Robert Preston for. It's his most famous film. He really never went beyond this. This is like the apotheosis of his career. I had seen enough of it through other sources. I think I told you off air, I knew this from The Simpsons by a Monorail. I saw that episode, which if anybody's seen that episode, it's essentially the same story, only Harold Hill is trying to sell Springfield on buying a monorail. I mean, I'd heard some of the other songs, 76 Trombones. I go to Disneyland a lot, and they have the soundtrack for this on Main Street USA. Just
Main Street is basically, River City.
Exactly. It is so River City. I liked portions of it. The problem is I think I'd seen so many movies that were similar, and especially when we talk about 1960s musicals, starting with the 50s, and I think going into the 60s, you saw a lot of emphasis on small town turn of the century Americana. I saw Hello Dolly before I saw this, and I also don't care for Hello Dolly the movie at all. I like this far more than I liked Hello Dolly, but it's hard not to see that they're very similar. I know people probably hate hearing it because I say it a lot. Had I seen it when I was younger, maybe that would have been different.
Which is exactly when I saw it.
I was going to say, you are a true believer. You've seen this movie several times. So what's your background with this?
I watched it probably to start in middle school. Really weird backstory there. I had kind of a big Ron Howard phase, watching a lot of Happy Days. My father had mentioned that, you know, it was little Ron Howard in there. So I was kind of drawn to it for Ron Howard. And then
billed as Ronnie Howard.
Little Ronnie Howard, even right probably at the beginning of his Opie days. I knew Shirley Jones from the Partridge Family, and I think I'd seen Oklahoma before that. It was probably in that first group kind of beyond. I think Singing in the Rain was what first had pulled me into musicals, and this was really close behind that. I saw it on stage when I was in New York years and years ago. I think Eric McCormick from Will and Grace was in the lead. I think I saw it when Craig Bierko was playing the lead for a while on stage. Saw the Matthew Broderick TV movie for it. So it's, I've kind of kept up on the different versions as the years have passed.
This is based on the 1957 Broadway musical by Meredith Willson.
The original, yes.
Yeah, and there were at least 40 songs that Meredith Willson wrote for the musical, and some are used in the stage show, some are used in this movie, some weren't used in either format. Meredith Willson just was really big on this concept and this idea of telling the story about a town that was very similar to one he grew up in.
He grew up in that small town, Iowa, right? It's based on... Right,
he grew up in Mason City. Yes, it's Mason City, Iowa. This was one of the biggest films of the year. And it's a huge, critically acclaimed movie. It's directed by Morton DeCosta, who only did 4 movies in his entire career. He was a Broadway director. Predominantly what he did was adapt musicals that he had made on stage. So he had worked on this stage show and he did the movie. He also did Anti-Mame and did that movie as well, mm-hmm. which funnily enough, Robert Preston is in the Lucille Ball version of Mame, which I haven't seen yet, but it is infamous for how bad it supposedly
is. Isn't that the one that Angela Lansbury will not talk about?
It might be. I haven't gotten to it yet. It's on my list as we wind down my Robert Preston filmography watch. And I've just heard that when we talk about people looking their age in this movie, supposedly Lucy really looked her age in Mame. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about Mame today. Let's talk about Robert Preston. We started this month with a look at his first film, or at least his first big film, when we talked about Union Pacific. Now we're talking about the movie that made him a star. And it only took...
Mm-hmm. 25 years, 25 give or take.
25 years. I've been going through his filmography in between doing these episodes. Robert Preston was known for having 2 genres. He was either the heavy in maybe like noirs, or he was the heavy in westerns. His filmography is just like filled with westerns, and literally if you've seen one, you've seen them.
Poor guy must have been so bored.
He's great in everything. It is a testament to his talent that he gives 110%. The occasional weird movie in there, I was gonna say I watched this right after I watched him in a movie from the 50s called When I Grow Up with a young Peter Pan, Bobby Driscoll.
And oh, you're kidding.
Yeah. But it's also set in turn of the century. Robert Preston plays this dad that doesn't know how to show his emotions to his son, who's kind of a troublemaker. And it ends incredibly depressed, but you really feel for Robert Preston's character. Oh. It's a very weird little movie, but that was what he did. He got the chance to play this character on the stage, and he did fantastically. And when they adapted this movie, they didn't want Robert Preston. They wanted somebody else, which was Jack Warner's thing when he bought the rights to stuff. He's like, well, we're not going to get the Broadway cast. Who cares about those people? Nobody wants to see them.
It's, you need like, a name.
Yeah. Watching West Side Story, like, they didn't want all those kids. Natalie Wood seemed like a better option. I swear I'm not going to grouse on Natalie in that movie anymore, because I love her. But... that was their shtick. So they looked for a different actor to play Harold Hill. The original choice was Phil Harris. Meredith Willson wanted Phil Harris, who was known as a big band singer. You might know him as the voice of Baloo.
Yes, that's from probably the Jungle his Book. Biggest role, I would say.
The Aristocats. He did a couple Disney movies.
Just Google "That's What I Like About the South," kids. Just Google that.
But he, of course, was traveling with his band. He didn't have time to make a movie, so they didn't get him. So then they asked the big heavy-hitting name. They asked Frank Sinatra, they asked Danny Kaye, they asked Gene Kelly, they asked Dan Daly. Cary Grant was offered the role, and he infamously said that if they didn't get Robert Preston to play the role of Harold Hill, not only was Cary Grant not going to star in it, he wasn't even going to see the movie. This is according to Ben Mankiewicz on the intro to this movie that I watched on Filmstruck. Cary Grant had said that as well when they talked about Rex Harrison, when he was offered the role of Henry Higgins in My Fair Lady. So we're not really sure if that was true at all, mm-hmm. if he said it for one movie or the other, if he said it for both. But yeah, Cary Grant kind of knew where it was at.
That story is pretty infamous. I know I've heard that so many different places.
Exactly. So Cary Grant might have just been grandiose. I don't really know.
Maybe he just didn't want the role.
Exactly. He realized that he was not a singer, okay? And he was Like, stop trying to put me in musicals. It's not going to happen.
I love Cary Grant. I love him with every fiber of my being, but I don't think he could have done that role.
Well, I was going to say, can you see any of these people playing the role? What is it about Robert Preston that makes him unique in this role?
I know a lot of Phil Harris's stuff. I could definitely see that. And Dan Daly, I could see, potentially. Maybe not going quite as big, but he is probably the closest thing to a Robert Preston I could think of. But Sinatra, Danny Kaye, Gene Kelly, I really don't think I can see that.
It's easy to see why someone like a Sinatra or a Gene Kelly would be attractive, because A, they're good looking guys. They have that ability to play con men without being threatening. Mm-hmm. You know, the whole point of Harold Hale as a character is that he is changed by both the small town and by love. Right. Sinatra and Gene Kelly, I mean, they're the guys pitching the woo. I wouldn't necessarily buy that they would decide to put down roots in this, like, podunk town for whoever, even if it's Shirley Jones.
Oh, definitely not Sinatra.
Yeah, no, definitely not Sinatra. Danny Kaye, he's a little too silly for me. I think he works better when he's throwing voices and doing costumes. Dan Daly, I've only ever seen play the drip in There's No Business Like Show Business, so I have really no prior knowledge of him. Cary Grant, I don't believe he could sing. So, Robert Preston is perfect.
He is.
I just wish we had got him maybe about 15 years earlier. Right. As Harold Hill, he's really good. He's got that patrician thing going on when he's bonding with Winthrop, who's Ron Howard. It's a very fatherly type of camaraderie, and you find Winthrop is grieving the loss of his own father, so they find that within each other. And Robert Preston, having seen so many of his roles playing this character, always played the light-fingered con man who could kind of try to convince you of things, but it was with this real gregariousness and this effervescence. It's not threatening, but it's also not malicious. I think we said that about his character in Union Pacific. It's not evil. I will say this is probably his most asexual role, because I've seen him in other westerns where he is definitely getting saucy with some ladies, and I was thinking, that's not really in here.
No chemistry at all in this one. Well, no, I was chemistry gonna say, at all.
He was 44, and he looks 44. Mm-hmm. Shirley Jones was 28. You and I are classic film girls. We've seen many a May-December romance.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't as bad, I think, as something like anything with Audrey Hepburn, like Love of the Afternoon or Sabrina.
Yeah.
But Robert Preston in color, you can just see where they're trying to hide his age, so there's not a lot of close-ups on him. His hair is lighter, there's no facial hair. His skin is very smooth, and they have, like, a lot of makeup on him to make him look really dewy. Mm-hmm. It's very easy to see that he is significantly older for the part, but he's still got it. I mean, he's fantastic in this.
It's such a dynamic performance, just such an active, dynamic performance. You can see DaCosta's direction, but just how it's shot, you can just see how dynamic it would have been on stage.
And I almost think that that's where the movie loses a little something, because when I think 1960s musical, I'm used to big, showy numbers. And there are a couple here, but there's not a lot of choreography. I have a real issue with some of the songs in this movie, which we'll get
really?
To.
Really? Okay.
And I almost thought this might be one of those movies that I don't think 100% works well on a film. Maybe had I seen the play, I don't really know. I mean, we can't say that he's not fantastic in this role. He's got this whimsy to him, you know, when we're first introduced to him on the train and everybody's talking about him and how he's got this, like, huge mythos associated with him. And then you see Robert Preston and you're like, that guy?
Aww.
But I think that's the point, is that that draws you into the story. If you had seen Sinatra say, I'm Harold Hill, you would have been like, oh, yeah, I definitely know how that worked out, man. Okay?
Yeah.
Like, he seduced everybody in this town, probably physically, and he's gotten all their money. Like, Robert Preston, you want to know how that happened. And I think that that works for a lot of the audiences at the time in 62. Because if you weren't paying attention to Robert Preston as the side guy in all of these movies, there is that unpredictability. You don't know how he's going to pull this off because you don't know him.
Right. I mean, and he had been largely away from Hollywood for, what, 5-6 years before this?
Yeah.
Because he had packed it up and gone to New York for a while, which was when he, stage version of this, in, what, 57? So he was out of the public eye, at least in terms of film in Hollywood, for a number of years. This was like his triumphant return.
Some actors just need that stage training and that time on Broadway in order to make their mark. And he definitely did. And he has at least another 20 years after this movie. Right after this, he did another big movie, How the West Was Won.
That's a huge film, yeah.
He reteamed with Morton DaCosta to make a movie called Island of Love. And then you're getting into the 70s. I think he returned to that character actor. By the time he's doing the 80s, he's parodying Hollywood, the Hollywood that disappeared. Again, I bring up stuff like Victor Victoria and SOB, where he's really lampooning the town that made him and kind of kept him from being something bigger.
Victor Victoria, probably another one of his best
movies. It is, and so different from quite literally everything that he did before it.
Mm-hmm.
Harold Hill is a great example of Robert Preston's career in microcosm. This guy that you knew was great, had he just been given the opportunity, but he finds that he can be this big fish in a small pond. And I think that really sums up his career for good and ill. It's a bit of a melancholy reading.
That's a fascinating reading. I've actually never heard that. I never thought of that way before.
Literally just came up with that. If we're listing three Robert Preston movies that you need to watch to really get a good feel for his career, I think we pretty much did the two, you know, Union Pacific and this, and then maybe Victor Victoria. But I want to bring up the plot, because this is a 2.5 hour movie.
It's interesting to me you said it felt long, because to me
it does feel long.
To me, it absolutely flies. And I was trying to look at that my last time watching it. Those music numbers hit you so fast. And I was kind of thinking it because they feel so fast and so regular that maybe for me it helps the pacing. But I can sit down, watch this movie, and it doesn't feel like that 2.5 hour behemoth at all.
I had a hard time not trying to compare this to other musicals. So stuff like The Sound of Music,
mm-hmm.
which is also very long. Somebody will probably say The Sound of Music feels even longer than this. And I would say I can understand how you would feel that. I think a lot of the criticisms that I have about this movie, somebody could throw at me and say, well, The Sound of Music doesn't have exorbitant choreography. Yes, I understand all of that. I think the problem with The Music Man, coming from somebody who has seen so many musicals, is that the plot has a really bizarre twist and turn nature. So you know that Harold Hill shows up in this town and he's gonna swindle everybody. There's one section where he's getting his bearings. I know in these small town Americana movies you need to have colorful characters, but you also have these weird divergences into following other characters. So you have the whole subplot with Shin and his wife, who's played by Hermione Gingold. And then you have Shin's daughter, who is dating Tommy Gilles, who's like the bad boy in the town.
Mm-hmm.
He's bad in the sense that they just keep saying he's mean, but he's like, he's white bread. He's fine.
Well, a lot of this movie has other people's impressions, because Marion is the same way.
Right. The movie kind of stops in the middle. Right around the time they were doing the weird sociable scene with the Shaboopy song.
Shaboopy.
I was sitting there thinking, I feel like we've kind of gone off the road a little bit. And I understand the intent. I mean, I get that the Meredith Willson and Morton DaCosta, I mean, the whole intent is to showcase what was presumably great about small town Iowa or small town America, which was the fact that everybody knows everybody. There's these very close-knit community events that are fun.
Right.
But then I just kept thinking about, like, Meet Me in St. Louis and how I think that movie works because there's this isolating element because you're focused on one family, but you're also getting the grander push outward into the world. I really wanted more of the Harold Hill trying to figure out how he was going to get out of this situation, because it feels like there's really no question or stopping for him to think of, how am I going to get out of this town? So when the angry mob finally comes for him, I was surprised he hadn't thought of an exit strategy. I mean, I know he mentions it a couple of times, but it doesn't really feel like he's made any plans to enact that. And I'm sure somebody's going to tell me, well, that's because he's in love.
I may or may not have just been thinking that. I'm like, he's blinded by love.
Right. And I mean, I get the whole career con, but for a career con man, I figured he would have had a moment. I think what I was really turned off by was that I didn't feel like we got any insight in the character's internal thought processes. Maybe that's what I'm going for. A lot of what happens and affects them is all external. It's film moments of the plot. But you never really know how Harold Hill feels about his life of crime. How it feels to not have roots. I thought his whole thing on Gary, Indiana was that he was lusting for this small town atmosphere that he didn't really get. I would have liked a little more interiority.
Maybe. I can actually see that argument. That's never been something that I've thought about when I was watching it. That's DaCosta's direction and being a fairly accurate depiction of the stage musical, which you aren't going to be dealing quite so much with the interiority.
That could be it. So I think I have a real hard time with these. And there were several of them. I mean, this is not a movie that exists in isolation. There were several small town Americana musicals that came out in the 60s. And I always seem to have a problem with them. Maybe I just don't relate to that. I don't know. That was kind of my thing for me. I did like the weird meta moments, though. I wish there had been more of them. There's a scene where, yes, Shirley Jones has her chance essentially to out Harold Hill as a fraud when this guy, this Anvil salesman, shows up, who is literally an ad for sexual harassment. And he keeps following her around. He's trying to go tell the mayor, but she wants to stop him because she doesn't. She has to protect Harold. There's a little, like, maybe she's going to take credit for it herself, but you just know that's because she loves him. She has to try to convince him to stay with her feminine wiles. And her mother, who's in the house, starts playing, I think it's the bolero from Carmen.
Yes.
And I was sitting there thinking, like, that's really inventive, that it's mood music that's created by the mother inside the house. So it would have been really easy to play that just as, like, non-diegetic music that you play on the score. That could have been a really easy thing for a composer to just play it over the score. But it's the mom in the house who's got the window open playing it. So it gives you that lure that they're making their own movie magic.
When you mentioned that, I kind of once again went to the Broadway thing, kind of seeing that as you're more crafting what you can show on that stage.
And that could be a reference to the stage musical, too. The fact that you have an orchestra in a pit that's conducting this music. I thought that was a really fun little aside, whether it's referencing the musical or whether it's referencing the scoring of film. Either way, I thought it was really inventive.
What's always jumped out to me is the iris moments.
Yeah.
It feels so out of place in terms of cinema. You see it used, a number of instances throughout the film. It's typically how they go out on a scene.
There's a lot of intriguing editing in this movie. For 1962, so you have the iris shots. I did like the binocular effect that you got, where it's the barbershop quartet singing Light a Rose with Marion singing her song.
That's such a cute way to craft that scene.
And again, it would have been very simple to have the barbershop quartet. They do at one point. They walk by while they're singing this song. It would have been very easy to blend the two of them. But you have this really great shot that looks like binoculars. It's almost a little bit of voyeurism. The audience is watching these moments that we're not supposed to be privy to.
Because she's sitting on her front porch. And then I believe they're on the front porch of, like, a local hotel or something. Shirley Jones and then one of the Buffalo Bills are in a rocking chair and very synced up. You can tell they're nowhere near each other.
Yeah, I did like the Buffalo Bills. They're the barbershop quartet in this movie. That's another meta moment that I appreciated in this film, because they start off as these just four random guys that show up. They're members of the town.
The school board. They hate each other.
Yeah, and you're told that they haven't gotten along in, like, 50-some-odd years. Harold Hill uses his whiz-bang to not only get them to get along, but to actually get them to sing in four-part harmony.
Yeah.
And so they become this weird Greek chorus throughout the entire movie, coming by and singing their songs.
Just to punctuate a scene.
Right! I thought that was really fun. Some other little asides that I really enjoyed. We got to talk briefly about Hermione Gingold.
Yeah, you could talk a lot about Hermione Gingold in this movie.
Yeah, Hermione Gingold is one of many, many unsung character actors in this movie. She plays
Mrs. Chin, the mayor's wife.
And I think she is utterly amazing in this movie. She is annoying, but very fun, very overly dramatic. I know Hermione Gingold is not one of the aunts in Bewitched, but she always reminds me of one of Samantha's aunts in Bewitched.
Yes, I can see that.
But she's so fun. When she's doing her Native American dance scene in the beginning, with the children. She comes out and she's gonna have this whole big moment, and then the firecracker goes off, and then she starts screaming,
"Oh, I've been shot!"
Exactly. I laughed out loud about that. And I don't know if it was because she's gonna have this like incredibly dated racist moment that's been stopped.
Good old-fashioned family racism.
Exactly. Or that she's talking in this weird Native American dialect that already sounds funny, and then it's like there's this huge boom behind her. I don't know. It's a very funny, perfectly composed moment that I think shows off her flair. That and her saying Balzac.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, every time she says Balzac.
Yeah, which I will be including a clip of that in this episode so that you guys can hear it, because I can't not. I mean, how can you?
It makes scenes in that movie. The part can be so small and in the hands of a different actress. It could totally blend in, but she is so just incredible and brings so much in such a small, thankless part.
You also have Mary Wicks in here.
Yes.
Mary Wicks.
You blink and you miss her.
Yeah, she's in this movie as well. Most modern people know her as Aunt March in the 90s version of Little Women, but she was also in some episodes of I Love Lucy.
White Christmas,
On the Town.
Whodunit, the Abbott and Costello film.
There's a lot of really great character actors in this. And this is a movie where Buddy Hackett doesn't annoy me.
You can't not love Shapoopy.
Oh, God. Buddy Hackett doesn't bother me like Jimmy Durante bothers me.
I can understand that one. That I can get. I love Buddy Hackett.
But they both have this very similar comedic styling that I just don't really get. But Buddy Hackett is really fun as Marcellus Washburn. I was surprised, considering it's Buddy Hackett, how little screen time he has.
He seems like big casting for, again, a sidekick part. He gets, the two music numbers? He gets Shapoopy and then the little part in Sadder But Wiser Girl for Me. I guess I've never really thought of him kind of as a top liner.
We're going to talk about Ronnie Howard. Tiny, adorable, gingery Ronnie Howard.
With a lisp.
With his lisp, who plays Winthrop. He's adorable. He's utterly adorable in this movie. As a child star, and I've seen many of them in the golden era of Hollywood, I like that he's a child star who plays a child. He's not overly intelligent. He's not overly precocious. He's not overly annoying. He's just a child. I was not convinced that Shirley Jones was his sister. That's his mother.
Yes. That's a very interesting family dynamic. I mean, you know that Winthrop was definitely a whoopsie.
There's a lot of weird ages in this movie regarding children. You see Shirley Jones' mom. Shirley Jones plays Mary in Peru. And you see her mother. And then you see little Ronnie Howard. Now, we're not sure how old Marion's supposed to be. But it's obvious there's about, 15?
I would say at least. I mean, I doubt Marion would be as young as 18, so there'd be at least 15, 20 years
between the two of them. So when did this woman give birth?
Marion is a definite, by this point, she's a spinster.
She's supposed to be an old maid, which I think old maid would have been about, 20?
I'd say 21, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so when did this woman give birth? Now, I say the same thing about the Shins. Because they have Zanita.
Zanita is the oldest girl.
The oldest girl. And Hermione Gingold is... Apparently the waters of River City are incredibly fertile.
There is one younger girl who you see a lot in the various shots in the music numbers. She's usually right off of Zanita's side. And she's probably got 11 or 12. And I think she is supposed to be Zanita's sister.
Whatever is being put in River City, I mean, you can get pregnant apparently long past your fertile times. But I did really like Ron Howard. I think his scene with Harold at the end, when he's going to tell him the truth, and he's like, well, are you a liar? And he's like, yes.
Oh, such a powerful little scene. Ron Howard just kills it. And for being, God, I think he was maybe 6 or 7.
I was going to say, I think 6.
And how he kills that scene at that age. And then the chemistry with him and Preston is just, I get a little misty when I watch that scene.
There is more chemistry between those two as like a father-son, I think, than there is between our lovers at times. Because I talk about how I wanted more interiority into Harold Hill, but that scene really encapsulates what I think the movie wants Harold Hill to represent. He fills this void for these people who don't have any excitement in their life. They're getting happy when the Wells Fargo wagon comes into town. And for Winthrop, he's the dad that isn't gonna lie to him, that's not gonna go away, that he can depend on. But I thought that that was really unique and sweet to watch. I do want to talk about Shirley Jones, too, because she's in this. Shirley Jones is a living legend. I've been fortunate to be near mm-hmm. her and ask her questions, and she is just fantastic.
Oh, good to know. Oh, I love her.
And she is still utterly flawless in her age. I mean, she is just fantastic. She was really the de facto singing star of the 50s into the 60s. I think people forget just how ubiquitous with the musical she had become. She had done 2 Rodgers and Hammerstein movies. She did Oklahoma in 55, mm-hmm. which oddly enough is a movie about Americana that I adore.
I love Oklahoma.
So go figure. I love Oklahoma. She also did Carousel in 1956.
One I'm less fond of.
I was going to say, one movie I do not care for. And then she did a lot of sweet family movies. In 60, she did Elmer Gantry.
Yep.
Which Elmer Gantry was her attempt to kind of reinvigorate that image. She didn't want to be the nice girl. So she decided to play a prostitute. And if anybody has seen Elmer Gantry, which I have, I love it. She is fantastic in that movie.
Well, she took home an Oscar for that, correct?
She did. Rightfully so, I would say, because she is spellbinding in that movie. If you think she is just sweetness and light, you've not seen Shirley Jones, like, sexual and, like, thirsty, because it is fantastic.
She gets to do that because a few years before, she's in April Love with Pat Boone. Once again, about as asexual as you can get.
This was an attempt to get back at that. She had done a Western in 61, but then I think this was trying to go back to, like, what we knew Shirley Jones for. And she's great, but she's great in Oklahoma. She's great in Carousel. So I didn't expect her to be bad in this movie. Mm-hmm. She's got a very nice voice. Her doing Till There Was You, which I did not know was a song associated with this movie until...
Oh, really? Yeah.
Well, I knew it was from The Wedding Singer, and I figured it was probably something famous from, like, the 40s or 50s.
See, I had heard the Beatles version first.
Yeah, Meredith Willson actually gets more money from the Beatles cover than he does from this.
Yeah, I read that, too.
She's very sweet, but... Would you say this is her best musical performance?
That's hard. I have always probably liked Oklahoma a bit better, just in terms of in her performances. I think vocally, I think she's absolutely dynamic in this. Because I have heard the original Broadway cast recording, and it's Barbara Cook, who is Marion in the original Broadway cast, I believe. She was just an insanely amazing, like, Broadway soprano, classically trained singer. And Shirley Jones, in terms of what was available in Hollywood at that time, that was as good and as close as you were going to get. She sells those songs like nobody else could. Performance-wise, I think Marion is such, and I was thinking it on this this watch-through particularly, she's such a hard character. She's got a lot of things going against her. And she could be so flat, and she's, the whole town is against her, and she's an old maid, she's a spinster, and it's like, oh, you poor thing.
I think because we don't really get a glimpse into Harold Hill's backstory, you're really reliant on Marion to give us some sort of human connection, because Harold is such a larger-than-life figure. Mm-hmm. I appreciated that she falls into the typical small-town ideal of what the beautiful spinster is. She's got the Wonder Woman-esque glasses on her, and she's suddenly not the most beautiful thing in the world.
Put her hair up and put those glasses on her, and she's a librarian.
But at the same time, you really understand the struggle that she's facing mm-hmm. being an older, by their standards, woman who's not married. She's taking it from all comers.
Yeah, she is.
I mean, the little girl Amaryllis.
I'm gonna be an old maid like you.
Exactly. She's like, well, don't you have somebody? You can't even wish on the wishing star because you don't have anybody. And I was just sitting there like, oh, God. She can't go to the footbridge, which I always thought was some sort of weird sexual metaphor. It's like, I get that it's like a lover's lane, but...
Sure enough, there's a footbridge.
I'm reading it deeper than I think these people intended. You really feel for that. And I think what also makes you connect to her character more is... There's a little turn-of-the-century slut-shaming going on there.
That storyline with Miser Madison, what the old hens, for lack of a better term, everything they say about her, to me, that's such a fascinating plot line. That's not something you would expect to see in such a Rockwellian Americana turn-of-the-century musical.
No, no. And you find out that the only reason they dislike her is that the library was left to the city, but the books were left to her.
They all assume she was sleeping with him.
And they're not really understanding what's going on. And you find out that he was her father's best friend, and she thought of him as an uncle. And I was sitting there thinking, how did these people not know that? It's a small town.
They should all know each other.
Right. How did they not know? And they just assume that this young girl has, like, obviously slept her way to getting books. I was like, really? You guys are arguing
about
books?
Of anything she could have slept her way to, she sleeps her way to the librarian post.
They're arguing over books. They still got the library. They couldn't buy books. According to them, she's checking out bad books. She talks about giving Persian poetry to a girl, and apparently that's inappropriate.
That opening scene where you see Marion and Mrs. Shin, Marion goes, well, wouldn't you rather have your daughter reading the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam than Eleanor Glynn? What Eleanor Glynn reads is her mother's problem.
Totally not understanding who Eleanor Glynn is. I think that is what makes the movie kind of a hard sell for modern audiences today.
Well, that's a very dated reference.
But also, Harold Hill's whole concept of shaking up the town is by flattery, giving into this concept of vice.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have your children doing this, they're going to be out at the pool hall.
Because they get a new pool table. They've only ever had billiards, and apparently there's a difference between pool and billiards, and I can't speak to that.
Yeah, I can't either. His whole thing is not to shake things up with this radical take-no-prisoners mentality. It's to very subtly say, think of your children. Don't you want to give them a hobby? Give them something to do. And at the same time, hoping that will change the rest of the town. And considering how the 60s would pan out, it's a bit silly, but it works. It could only work in this small town.
Exactly.
We have to point out, how long did it take for you to notice watching this that Shirley Jones was pregnant?
Well, the first time I saw this, there's this very old featurette that plays before it in all the versions I've seen. So I actually knew about it going in. Because she talks about all of that and the costuming and
the costuming in this for her is fantastic. Because I don't think people really realize how pregnancies are hid. Because most actresses don't necessarily make movies when they're pregnant. They try not to.
This was a surprise.
This is very surprising. Because a lot of the dresses, I mean, obviously they're turn of the century. So it's a lot of high collars, long sleeves, long skirts. You could have maybe gotten away with stuff that's billowy, but here they have these ribbons around her middle that progressively get wider as the movie goes on to draw your eye away from her stomach. The first half of the movie, she's mm-hmm. very thin, and you're like, okay, well, I can't really tell. By the time they get to the shaboopy scene, it is impossible not to notice that she has gotten to easily be mm-hmm. about 5-6 months pregnant.
You can see it's right after Trouble. Harold Hill takes off and follows her home. She's wearing this gigantic coat, and she's carrying her purse up in front of her, like, right at chest level. It looks like every single technique that they use on television to hide pregnancies all at once.
And it's very subtle. I mean, usually I think most people expect pregnancy to be hid by, like, not giving us full body shots. Mm-hmm. And this movie doesn't do that. It doesn't hide the fact, but you're really not noticing it. Obviously, we would have noticed had she been, you know, 7-8 months along. But I think it works really well. And the fact that she can still high kick and dance and do all this stuff while she's carrying a child, it's a testament to her professionalism that she's doing this. Because I'd have been like, nope, I'm not doing that. Get a body double.
She was far enough along because you've heard the story about how the baby kicked her until there was you.
Her and Robert Preston are so close together. And Robert Preston started to freak out because he was feeling the baby move. And yeah.
The story is that she didn't tell it. The condition was she couldn't tell anybody. Which includes all her coworkers. And yeah, they're embracing so close and the baby kicks and he felt it.
I was thinking, we know that River City is apparently able to make women who are too old to have a baby pregnant. Maybe Harold Hill is so awesome that he can just impregnate women through osmosis.
one twinkle of the eye.
Yes, it's totally possible. Totally possible. We haven't talked about the songs yet. I mentioned that I was not necessarily a fan of the musical stylings. The first couple of songs where it's talk singing. And the emphasis is on syncopation.
Mm-hmm.
So the opening song on the train, where they're trying to mimic the movement of the train. I need melody. I need high notes and low notes. I can't do... It's why I don't like My Fair Lady, because Rex Harrison cannot sing.
Okay, yeah.
But then once they get to the small town and you're getting songs like Till There Was You,
right,
or the Barbershop Quartet, 76 yeah. trombones, I like those. But I don't think Robert Preston is allowed to... I mean, he was a fantastic singer. If anybody's seen some of his westerns where he sang, he had a beautiful voice. And I don't necessarily know if this movie lets him shine with that voice.
See, that actually interests me, because I haven't seen him sing in other roles. So I just kind of assumed that that was what he brings.
He sings a little bit in Victor Victoria, too.
I always kind of equated it to being more untrained, and because the performance that he brings to those songs is what sells it. It's the athleticism, I keep using the word, but dynamic.
I'm all for different musical styles. I'm used to, like, Hello Dolly and stuff like that. It was a little different. It may be different didn't work for me, but...
In the hands of Gene Kelly, something like Hello Dolly is going to be very traditional.
What are some of your favorite, least favorite songs in this movie?
Marion is probably definitely my top.
We're going to talk about Marion and that song in a second, because that's actually my favorite song. So.
I love that. And then for some reason, I love The Sadder But Wiser Girl for Me.
I think the Marion, the librarian number is that pure musical moment
mm-hmm.
that I don't know if the movie necessarily builds on from after that. It's a very surreal set piece. And I know we're used to singers and musicals bursting into song, but there's this very dreamy quality to it. The way that the guys are all like dancing with each other in a line and Marion gets swept up in it. I love how the library is set up, really. I think it's a really great example of set design.
It's like it's built specifically for a music number or something.
Exactly. It's built like they're gonna dance in it. I don't know. The spiral staircase, and you have people dancing from all angles. And it goes on. It's a very long musical moment that just builds on top of each other. You get everything that you want from it. And it's, again, got that Carmen-esque type of languid Spanish style to it that really works.
What I actually noticed this time through, I was surprised I never noticed it before. It actually got me to look at IMDb. I was watching it, Marion, and I'm like, this feels like Bye Bye Birdie. Why
yes,
does this feel like Bye
yes.
Bye Birdie? And then I looked, you know, looking up Anna White, the choreographer, I had completely forgotten that she choreographed Bye Bye Birdie.
That explains so much.
The similarities between that, because where I felt it was in the telephone hour in Bye Bye Birdie, which is, again, like a very dreamlike, very surreal, not cinematic number. They're taking a step above cinema.
Now that you bring up Bye Bye Birdie, that explains so much about why I felt this was similar to Bye Bye Birdie.
Mm-hmm.
I do want to talk about some of the other musicals. You saw in the 60s a lot of turn of the century. We brought up stuff like Hello Dolly. Meet Me in St. Louis was the 40s.
You have Bye Bye Birdie right around this time, which, not turn of the century, but small town. I mean, Sweet Apple, Ohio.
Other popular musicals that were popular in the 60s include stuff like Finian's Rainbow, How to Succeed in Business Without yeah. Really Trying, Goodbye Mr. Chips they did in 69. Hollywood's always been really obsessed with the concept of small towns, and I think this is the apotheosis of it.
There. Starting at the beginning, Harold Hill gets off the train and they all start singing to him about just being stubborn people from Iowa. You have a very direct reference to Rockwell, farmer and the wife with like the pitchfork.
It's American Gothic.
Yes. I mean, straight from Rockwell, who's the epitome of small town Americana.
And I think it's worth pointing out, this came out alongside two other musicals, one of which was set in this return to the land. You had the remake of State Fair.
Yes.
That was also in 62.
Just got done writing an article on that one, actually.
And you also have Gypsy.
Yes.
That came out the same year as this, which also has Natalie Wood and Rosalind Russell, who was in another Morton DeCosta film, Anti-Mame. It all comes back
and
around.
There you're dealing with vaudeville, so you're seeing lots of small towns, turn of the century.
Yeah, this return to simple pleasures. And I really think that that's what you were getting as people were trying to figure out what the end of the 50s meant.
Well, you see the transition towards the firestorm that the 1960s would become. You see that starting in the 50s and the early 60s. You see that starting to pop up, almost like a denial of it. Things are starting to change. Things are transitioning. Things are not as simple as they used to be after the war.
And you'd also see this real return of Broadway to theaters and television. 63, you get the adaptation of Bye Bye Birdie. 65, most people know the adaptation of Cinderella that played on television. My favorite version of Cinderella, probably one of my favorite musicals.
Is that?
The Leslie Ann Warren.
Okay, that's what I was going to say.
Who was in Victor Victoria with Robert Preston. All comes back around. I think that that's part of the problem, is that there were just so many movies that I had seen before that had similar beats to this. And this one doesn't have an intermission, which I thought was really funny, considering most of those Broadway movies did have intermissions. So.
The Sound of Music's got to be as long as this, if not close.
Yeah, this and is longer. I think Sound of Music
You even get an intermission in Sound of Music.
Yeah, Sound of Music, I think, is longer. I do want to bring up, before we get to the end, because I do want to talk about the end, this was remade in 2003 with Matthew Broderick and Kristen Chenoweth. I did not see that because I had never seen the original and I figured I really didn't need to. You've seen it. How does that compare to this?
It's been a long time since I've seen it. I mean, I love Matthew Broderick, but he, I thought, was not the greatest casting choice for that. It felt wrong to me. I mean, when I think of Matthew Broderick, I think of Leo Bloom in The Producers. I thought it was just spot on casting. Yeah. He doesn't have the big, brash persona that a character like Harold Hill needs.
It's why I say, I mean, if we're talking Matthew Broderick, you need like Ferris Bueller Matthew Broderick.
Exactly. When they relaunched it on Broadway in the early 2000s, the original Harold Hill for the remake was Craig Bierko, who brings kind of a similar big brash. I haven't seen him around lately, but people who, I believe he was in what, Scary Movie 3 or 4 is probably where most people would remember
or
him.
Cinderella Man if you want something like good. You bring up my next thing, which is everybody always has this concept of like who could play him now if they remade it, because we know everything old is new again. And if we live in a world where Steven Spielberg can remake West Side Story, then we live in a world where they can remake this. So who do you think could play Harold Hill out of today's celebrity men?
Unoriginal, but Hugh Jackman.
Ooh.
I want to see Hugh Jackman do it.
I think Greatest Showman took that thunder.
Yeah, well, and he did. I can't remember which talk show he was on. He was on somebody's late night show. And he did the entire first number all by himself. He did it spot on, all the parts, all the syncopation, everything.
That would be interesting.
Since then, I have always wanted to see him take that part. Of everybody out there, I think he would just absolutely kill it.
Somebody asked me to do an actual article on this, and I haven't done it, so I'm going to share it here. I mean, I definitely think if we were going to remake it, it's unoriginal, but I'd say Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Ooh, okay.
Or if we want to go with another Hamilton, Aaron Burr, Leslie Odom Jr., I think would be great.
Mm-hmm.
And then I always throw out, because I throw him out for everything and everybody expects me to say it, Oscar Isaac would be a really great Harold Hill.
Physically, yeah. Has he played with the singing? I'm not familiar enough with his career.
You did not see Inside Llewyn Davis?
Oh, true.
I think he could do it. As far as who could play Marion in today's world. Because again, you do need somebody who could sing.
And you need a range, too, on Marion.
I mean, Brie Larson I thought would be cute. I just saw her in a musical. The musical wasn't good, but she was good. Because you need somebody that's got a little bit of a tenacity to her, but is also quiet and restrained. I think of someone like Tessa Thompson, too, if anybody has seen her recently. I'm just trying to mix it up a little bit. So, yeah, those are some options. Wait till tomorrow when they announce that they're greenlighting a remake of The Music Man. People are going to...
I wouldn't put it past them at all.
So let's briefly talk about the ending.
You have the romantic plotline kind of build to a crescendo. Harold and Marion are as, you know, close as we see them. But then right after Shapoopy, we have the anvil salesman kind of tell Mayor Shin everything. And then your mob scene breaks out. Talking tar and feathers, torches. They're going to get Harold Hill. They're going to teach him a lesson. They're going to run him out of town on a rail. So we have alternating shots between everybody trying to chase down Harold, and then Harold is with Marion, but then Winthrop figures everything out. So they kind of all meet in front of the house. You have the emotional scene with Winthrop. Harold realizes he can't leave these people despite everybody telling him just to get out of town. He's captured by the mob and brought to the school, where we have the entire town get together wanting their money back. There's no instruments. There's no where is my boy. Marion ultimately gets up, argues for the integrity of the town, that everything he brought to the town, even if there's no instruments and no music. She eventually sways everybody.
The boys come together. They've learned to play the minuet in G on their instruments. Not well.
Through the think system.
Which I was really surprised. I was waiting for them to just, like, through the power of movie magic, be fantastic.
I love how as he's getting ready to conduct, he goes, think, men.
The parents, though, are really happy about the fact that their sons have learned a skill and that they are able to play an instrument. The boys march out of the town hall and are transformed into this marching band with uniforms.
A full-sized professional college marching band.
March down the street with Harold Hill conducting. And the movie just ends. I was like, wait, I saw credits being displayed. I was like, wait, that's it? That's the end? You know, I don't know what I expected. I think of, again, The Sound of Music and them crossing over this mountain into Austria or wherever they're going in The Sound of Music, I forget.
Well, and I think we have, with Till There Was You and everything that happened right after that, you kind of have the romantic plot closed up as much as they're going to get it. I think they're going to be an item. You've got Winthrop's, you know, unofficial father, kind of all of that is closed up, so they tie that up neatly. And that final sequence, kind of as they're marching down the street, what I thought of watching this last time is, once again, going back to the stage musical, it felt like curtain calls. You kind of have all the characters grouped together by type, and they all get their moment with their caption,
yeah,
and curtain down.
Yeah, it was very surprising, maybe because I'm just too used to movies ending with this big show-stopping number. So I can't say I was necessarily impressed by how it ended. Maybe I expected it to be too similar to other movies. That could be my fault. The movie was nominated for 6 Academy Awards, 5 nominations, 1 win. It won for Best Musical Score when musical score was sectioned into adaptation or treatment and original. So this won for Best Musical Score. It was nominated for Best Picture, Costume Design, Art Direction, Film Editing, and Sound Recording. So a lot of text and picture, which is weird. This would have been 62. Music Man was nominated alongside The Longest Day, Mutiny on the Bounty, To Kill a Mockingbird, and was beaten by Lawrence of Arabia.
Ouch. That's a hard year.
And it's really funny to look at the year before this and the year after this were lighthearted. West Side Story was a musical. Tom Jones was a comedy stage show.
Mm-hmm.
And The Music Man is the most bizarre outlier in this list. And you would see this a lot as the 60s would progress into the 70s. Hollywood really held on as long as it could to what it knew with the Oscars. The Music Man is this real vestige of the old 50s mentality surrounded by these war films, epic, serious social dramas like To Kill a Mockingbird. Still shocked To Kill a Mockingbird didn't win that year. And then you would see musicals win 2 years in a row in 64, 65 with My Fair Lady and The Sound of Music. And it would slowly start to change. 67, In the Heat of the Night won. Oliver won in 68. And then you have Midnight Cowboy in 69. And it all is culminating to 67's kind of the year everybody says that the studio system up and quit.
I was about to say, the studio system was basically dead, yeah, by 62,
yeah,
but it was officially DOA by 67.
Yeah, when In the Heat of the Night, along with Bonnie and Clyde, The Graduate, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and then you have Dr. Doolittle. That's essentially how I see the 62 Oscars. Dr. Doolittle is Music Man in this instance, surrounded by other more socially relevant films. It's an example of the old guard. It's trying to capture something that is slowly disappearing. Mm-hmm. I will say I enjoyed seeing it. I like that I can finally say that I've seen it. But I do think other musicals have done it better. Other actors have done it better. I mean, Robert Preston, this is the role he's remembered for, and rightfully so.
Yes. I mean, in terms of this role, Robert Preston is the ultimate.
Yeah. I mean, it looks great, but maybe had I not seen Hello, Dolly. Keep in mind, I don't like Hello, Dolly. I like this far more than I like Hello, Dolly.
I will fight for one thing on that, little Michael Crawford.
I like this way more than I like My Fair Lady. So I'm very finicky when it comes to 60s music.
And the 60s as a decade for the big budget stuff was hard because things were crumbling around them.
They're trying so desperately to tap in to the zeitgeist.
Because we're right at the same time as Cleopatra, which put the nail in, what was it, Fox's coffin?
Fox, yeah. So you're really seeing them trying to hold on to something. Kim, I want to give you the final thoughts on this movie. What do you think about this? Because I know probably most people listening to this are like, Chris is totally wrong. So do you recommend the movie? What are your overall thoughts
on terms of 60s musicals? It's one of my favorites, even in the scope of 1950s, 1940s musicals. I mean, on my personal list, this is kind of right up with Singing in the Rain and Meet Me in St. Louis for me. This is Robert Preston at his peak in a role that's really made for him.
Yeah.
Shirley Jones, once again, near her top of her peak, especially with her singing. I mean, she's lasted so long and is such a legend as someone who watched The Partridge Family when I was really, really young. Just the character actors. You don't see a combination of character actors like Mary Wicks and Paul Ford, who we didn't really talk about a lot, is just absolutely amazing. There's so much working for this movie. There's little flaws, but it holds a little nostalgic place in my heart.
Listeners, you can tell me your thoughts on The Music Man or Robert Preston or anything you want. You can email them to me at ticklishbiz@gmail.com and I can read them on the next episode. I'd like to thank Kimberly Pierce once again for joining us this entire month to talk about Robert Preston. Kim, where can fans find and get in touch with you online?
Easiest place to find me, I am always on Twitter. I'm at kpierce624. You can check out my writing over at Geek Girl Authority. And then I am on Citizen Dame with Kristen here weekly. You can check us out on anywhere you can download podcasts and then on citizendamepod.com.
That'll close out this edition of Ticklish Business. You can listen to Ticklish Business a variety of ways, either directly at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio and Player FM, or on iTunes. If you are listening via iTunes, please consider helping the podcast out by leaving a rating. Review's always nice, but a rating is better at this point. As always, you can contact me directly at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, at gmail.com, or visit me at my official website where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. The podcast is also on Twitter at ticklish_biz. Want to learn more about upcoming episodes or hear exclusive content before anyone else? Then consider supporting Ticklish Business via Patreon. I have a wealth of amazing perks, exclusive content, more of which is going to be going up in the coming days, and all your donations go right back into making Ticklish Business the premier classic film podcast it is. Also, anyone who becomes a patron in the month of April is eligible for a secret prize pack from the Ticklish Biz Vault. So if you're interested in becoming a patron, just head over to patreon.com/ticklishbiz. Are you enjoying the centennial celebration and want to learn more about the stars turning 100 this year? If you're a member of TCM's exclusive fan club, TCM Backlot, you can read my year-long centennial celebration series about the stars spotlighted in the podcast. I talk about films and information that you won't hear on the show. Next time, we start a new month with a new star. April is all about actor William Holden, as Diana Bosch joins me to talk about the 1950 drama Sunset Boulevard. Till next time.
Ball set.